In a moment, we're going to be looking into 1 Samuel in chapter 22. And while you're turning there to 1 Samuel 22, I'd like to say that I really appreciate this congregation. You know, you take things for granted that you're surrounded with constantly, but I got a call early this morning from Jan Donovan that just served to illustrate what a privilege it is to be here. She wanted you all to know how much she deeply appreciated she and Mark Bowe, prayers you've been offering for the struggles they've been having physically. Many ups and downs and setbacks with various drugs have been tried for both of them and then failed to help them with their problems there. But they do seem to be mending a little bit. They hope to be with us again this evening. But in the process of saying how much she appreciated your prayers, and would I please mention to you that appreciation, she then told me how she had heard about the Coburg Road congregation up in Alaska, which is a fur piece from here. Okay? And what a great reputation you all had up there. And then as they were getting ready to leave, various people they knew from around the country who had had experiences and spoke well of Coburg Road. And they had some ties to family or something. I forget how it all went, but she had three or four different sources all over the country and as far off as Alaska that just really illustrated the reputation you have for faithfulness and for your dedication to all things biblical and divine. So appreciate that. I'm sure we all will be continuing our prayers for the Donovans, for Hank's son, Jr., and for so many others that are on that very lengthy sick list. If you have been with us these last few months, you'll know even from just last week I mentioned that we're well past now the halfway point in a study of the book of Psalms. And especially with last week's lesson and again today, there's sort of a two-parter thing. I'd like to focus more than we have been on the background for the particular Psalms, the two of them that we'll consider here this morning. And so if you recall from last week, we saw that David's life very conveniently really falls into seven major areas. The time at home as a youth with his parents, time that he served in Saul's court as this extremely capable musician, the time that he spends fleeing from Saul, which is the time period that many of the Psalms are written in, and both of the Psalms we'll consider this morning were written during that time. And then he becomes king over the southern part of Israel, a smaller portion of the land, for 7.5 years before he'll be recognized and accepted as king over all of Israel for then another 33 years reigning in Jerusalem. But his own son will revolt against him. He'll be forced to flee the palace there, live in the wilderness again, and then will be able to return. Of course, his son will be killed, and he will live out his last years in Jerusalem itself. So David lives to the age of 70. It's all the years that he had. By reason of strength, we are told, you might make it to 80, and David didn't even make it so far as that. But when you appreciate how hard his life was, it's not difficult to understand how it is that he would perish from this earth as a result of perhaps fewer years than many of us would expect to attain now. And so we're looking at that number three, the period of time where he's fleeing from David. We looked at chapter 16, though, as a complete background, see that he was anointed there. So from the very beginning and as a youth, he knew that he was destined to become king. And so he's aware of this. He's the musician in the court. He kills Goliath. By chapter 18, then, he is renowned among the people of Israel. He has enormous popularity as a youth for his musical abilities, but also, of course, for having conquered Goliath. And now we have chapters 19 through 31, in which he just suffers horribly. It's all the way to the end of 1 Samuel. As we look at that, the first time David appears in Scripture, he's in the 16th chapter of 1 Samuel. Three chapters later, verse 19, had some good things go down, you know, in the beginning, but it's a pretty brief beginning. He then begins this enormously long period of time where he is suffering for simply being the one that God had chosen. Perhaps it's a part of his training. We often, I think, rightly and wisely recognize that. In suffering, you will learn about yourself and learn about others. You will learn about your faith in circumstances such as those, which you just can't learn by a life of ease. And so maybe it is. It is all considered a matter of training and preparation for his becoming king. But whatever the purpose, which God does not specifically state, his life is just really, really, really tough. He goes from, you know, favored son in the palace, and so with all of the perks that would come with that, to living out in this wilderness. Where we left him last week was in the first two verses of 1 Samuel 22. So David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard, they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was discontented gathered to him, and he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him. Well, there likely and apparently were also women and children that are gathering themselves about David. His own household, of course, has now joined him there. He is still yet a youth. And so these are really tough circumstances. And I pointed out that the cave of Adullam may in fact be that actual cave right there, though we're not entirely certain so many years later. It nonetheless is barren territory, hard. You know, it's just rocky caves, and that kind of a life is difficult. It's uncomfortable, but it's dangerous as well. Injuries are numerous. You are suffering constantly when you're forced to be enduring, surviving, fleeing, escaping, you know, into circumstances like that, going into rougher territory precisely because you're trying to make it more difficult for your pursuers to succeed in their attempt upon your life. Well, that brings us then to verses 3 through 5. And David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, so he's effectively outside of the nation itself entirely now, and he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and my mother come and stay with you until I know what God will do for me." Then he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. And the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah." So David departed and went into the forest of Hereth. Now, again, we don't know exactly where these areas are, and we're not given a lot of information about it. But it appears, brethren, that, again, David is so hated and hounded by the reigning king of Israel, and therefore, through that king's influence, you know, is also despised by the larger portion of those who are Israelites at this time. That in these circumstances, David is being driven from one place to another, but apparently out of both love and perhaps fear for their own lives, his parents join him for a little while. His siblings join him for a little while. It looks like there, you have to read between the lines a little bit, but how many times have you seen it? Somebody in America commits a crime, a big crime, a serial killer, you know, an arsonist, they do something really huge. And then you see all of the reporters flocking, you know, to interview the parents. Well, that would be torture, you know, enough. But of course, David and his family aren't experiencing that. But you'll also have those reporters today telling us about the graffiti that, you know, is on the house and the death threats that they get in the mail and over the internet, and how very many times the parents and families' lives of, you know, are torn equally apart, and they're driven out of their homes. They flee for safety's sake, you know, to live with relatives or get an apartment or something like that. And it appears maybe this is what's happening with David. And again, he's being driven to Moabites. Now, he had to work with the Philistines, the mortal sworn enemies of Israel, for all the years past. And now with the Moabites, again, not friendly to Israel. David's life has descended, brethren, into just chaos. And so the families come for an unstipulated reason, whether it's fear or love, but they can't stay with him. It's too dangerous. So he has to send them off, you know, to live in Moab now. And David first is in wilderness desert area, and then whatever this forest of Hereth is, it's extremely difficult to identify it today. But I don't want to leave the wrong impression. You're spoiled. You're really spoiled. When you make forest, you make Oregon. You make forest, you make majestic and towering and imposing and, you know, really, really beautiful.
because it's big, it's stately. Not so in Israel. Don and I have been in assuming that over 2,000 years, the forests are essentially, you know, the same. They're really very short trees, and they're much, you know, broader. They're not tall and skinny like we are. We think of a forest, you know, like troops marching, you know, off the battle or something. It's not like that at all. And so he was probably in what we would think of as kind of scrubby terrain with trees that are perhaps not much more than, say, 20 feet, something like that. They're not 40, 50, 60 giants like we're used to. And he's just suffering and worrying for his parents' sake that he has to, you know, send them off into Moab. These verses 3, 4, and 5, brethren, don't take long to read, but they encompass a period of time in David's life that is just horrifyingly miserable, physically, challenging, intellectually, because he's fleeing. He has to be strategically aware to try and avoid attacks. And then, of course, emotionally, he's torn apart with his family, you know, driven, for some unexplained reason, out of their homes and their territory, and now off in a foreign land, you know, with the Moabites, and hoping, you know, that's going to go well. Of course, any friend of my enemy is a friend of mine, and so the Moabites are, you know, a little more agreeable to David and his problems there, since now he has become an enemy of Israel. It is this period of time, brethren, apparently, seems pretty sure, that Psalm 63 is written. So let's go over now with all of this in mind and see if we can't grasp a little more thoroughly what it is that David is experiencing emotionally and intellectually and physically as he writes this psalm. And then, when you get over to Psalm 63, be sure you grab your pen or your pencil there and write in the margin, 1 Samuel 22, 3 through 5. 1 Samuel 22, 3 through 5. What we have as an inspired title there is the Psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. Well, that's the territory we've just been describing in verses 3 through 5 of 1 Samuel 22. And during this time frame then, David writes this, O God, you are my God. I will seek you earnestly. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh yearns for you. In a dry and weary land where there is no water. And I hope to try and draw this out last week, but you can certainly see it again in this first verse, you know, this week. So sure, we read about a dry land and being thirsty, and we read about my flesh is yearning for you. You know, and so we get it, you know, we understand the words. But if you can see a man who is covered head to toe in dirt, you see a man whose clothing is ragged, you see a man who doesn't have a lot of gear, he has to sleep in a cave. You see a man with a hardscrabble existence and 400 others that have joined themselves to him who are the complainers and disaffected people of the culture, the ones that are declared to be discontent. You see a ragtag, rough-and-tumble bunch of guys under an enormous amount of pressure who have to go out hunting every day if they're to eat at all, while they worry about being attacked, you know, in some sort of an ambush, fearing for their lives every moment. Their flesh is weary, their flesh is bruised, their flesh is torn, their minds are in agony for fear and concern for themselves and for others. It is emotionally, mentally, and physically as challenging and distressing as you could ever be. And what does David say? You are my God. He's got not the least bit of blame to point at God. He's got not the least bit, you know, of anger at his God. There's not any doubt about his God. When he's in circumstances like these, oh God, you are my God, he praises him. I will seek you earnestly. He draws closer rather than farther. My soul thirsts for you. Well, brethren, his body is thirsting too. My flesh yearns for you. It yearns for comfort. It yearns for the things that will make it feel better so that it isn't suffering. And David takes the very awful physical circumstances and he turns them into illustrations of how his spirit responds
to his God. Saul, my flesh is thirsty. I'm thirsty. My soul is thirsty for my God as well. In a dry and weary land where there is no water. Brethren, even the forests in Israel are of the nature that frequently, you know, they're in very arid regions. That's why the trees are not so giant as they are here where they're so well watered. And so then he says in verse 2, thus I have beheld you in your sanctuary to see your power and your glory, because your loving kindness is better than life. My lips will praise you. So I will bless you as long as I live. I will lift up my hands in your name. My soul is satisfied with marrow and fatness, and my mouth offers praises with joyful lips. Brother, again, if we're looking at this comparison, as the poet is apparently drawing from his circumstances to write this song now in praise to his God, think about that verse 2. I have beheld you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory. I'm not so sure, brethren, that he means in Jerusalem, I've seen the tabernacle. We don't have a temple yet. But it's the sanctuary of God. Well, yeah, you know, it's the tabernacle, and it's all okay. But maybe not. Maybe what he's saying is, Lord, I have been thrust out into this wilderness. I don't have a roof over my head, and I am in the sanctuary of God. I am in the earth that you have created. And while it is bruising and abusing to me to have to live like this, I love you, I seek you, I praise you, I have all confidence in you. You are everything. I'm where I belong, apparently at this time in my life, in the sanctuary of my God. And in verse 3, your loving kindness is better than life. Brethren, it is difficult. It's not natural for you to be hurting and suffering and under so much, you know, trouble as he is right there, and then to think in terms of this is God's loving kindness. But David can, and David does. And David then leads us, guides us into that understanding. Wherever we are, whatever we are experiencing, no matter how horrible that it is, regardless of the losses that we suffer, this is the sanctuary of God that we live on and in, planet Earth. And he is the creator of that sanctuary worthy of praise. And it is his loving kindness and his mercy that allows me to draw my very next breath. All is well when nothing is well. If I am right with my God, if it is well with my soul. This is Psalm 63. Well, now he says in verse 6, and try to imagine what sort of a bed he has in the cave of Adullam and out in Moab and the strongholds in the wilderness and in the forest of Horeb. When I remember you on my bed. That bed wasn't much, brethren. You know, it was no four-poster. And he says then, I meditate on you in the night watches. For you have been my help. And in the shadow of your wings, I sing for joy. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. But those who seek my life to destroy it will go into the depths of the earth. They will be delivered over to the power of the sword. They will be a prey for foxes, but the king will rejoice in God. Everyone who swears by him will glory, for the mouths of those who speak lies will be stopped. That's not hard to count. There's 11 verses. They're all effectively exactly the same size there. And you've got 8 of them out of the 11 that do what? Praise God and thank him. And then you've got this very much smaller percentage, only 3, that says, I know that justice will come. I know that those who are seeking to kill me will fail, and they'll die. They'll go into the depths of the earth. The animals will eat their bodies. But the king will rejoice in God. Everyone who swears by him will glory, for the mouths of those who speak lies will be stopped. What a man this is. what an understanding he has of his God. Now remember, brethren, I had chapters 19 through 31 is all the time of persecution. This is 22. Okay, so we've got a long way yet to go. David has this attitude, even though he's only at the beginning and worse is going to come. Let's see if, you know, he continues to have that attitude. So come on back to 1 Samuel. And in 1 Samuel chapter 22, we're just going to continue reading. Now, I don't have time. I'm about to close up. It won't take us much longer to finish up. But I want you to do just remember all of chapter 21, or really chapter 21, 1 through 10, I guess it is. You know, just scan that for a moment and remember. He met Ahimelech the priest in 21. The priest helped him, fed him, and returned to him the very sword of Goliath, which David had taken when he had killed the giant. So he's met Ahimelech. Then he left. We went through all these different areas that we have seen, Cave of Adullam, and in Moab, and now the Forest of Erech. So some time has passed, but not a whole lot of time, when we get to verse 6 of 22, chapter 22. Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now Saul was sitting in Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing around him. Well, he's not living like David does. And Saul said to his servants who stood around him, "Hear now, O Benjamites, will the son of Jesse also give to all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? For all of you have conspired against me, that there is no one who discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there's none of you who's sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in ambush as it is this day." Brother, it's true that his son Jonathan loved David. And it's true he conspired with him to keep him alive. But it's not true that he was stirring up people against him. This man Saul's manifesting the craziness that you see throughout all of his life here. But in verse 9, as he's whining about how tough his life is, Doeg the Edomite, who was standing by the servants of Saul, answered and said, "I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent someone to summon Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's household. The priests who were in Nob, and all of them came to the king. And Saul said, 'Listen now, son of Ahitub.' And he answered, 'Here I am, my lord.' Saul then said to him, 'Why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me, in that you've given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise up against me by lying in ambush as it is this day?'" Have you read anything about David lying in ambush for Saul? "Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, 'And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, even the king's son-in-law, who is captain over your guard and is honored in your house?'" Well, he had been, but he isn't now. 15, "Did I just begin to inquire of God for him today? Far be it from me. Do not let the king impute anything to his servant or to any of the household of my father, for your servant knows nothing at all of this whole affair." You got to like a hymn right here. Whoa, who's he talking to? The mad king of Israel. And who does he refuse to back down for? A mad king of Israel. So in 16, the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's household." The king said to the guards who were attending him, "Turn around and put the priests of Jehovah to death, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew that he was fleeing and did not reveal it to me." But the servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hands to attack the priests of the Lord. Then the king said to Doeg, "You turn around and attack the priests." And Doeg the Edomite, he's the rat, turned around and attacked the priests and killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. And he struck Nob, the city of the priests, with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and infants, also oxen, donkeys, and sheep he struck with the edge of the sword. Verse 19 now, we're turning to Saul's army, I think, not Doeg himself, but devastation falling upon the people in their city. 85 priests are killed. But in verse 20, one son of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped, fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. And then David said to Abiathar, I knew on that day, when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul, I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household. Stay with me. Do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. You are safe with me. Brethren, I don't guess any of us have something to compare with this. Close as I can go all my life was at the age of 21 working on a job site. I was up at a second story window one time, tearing walls out, pulling sheetrock down, and I had a section. It was kind of awkward. It was maybe like about 3 feet square. And I got out, the window there without looking. I hurled that thing out the window, and it sailed on down, and the guy I was working with in the back of the truck where we were going to take it to the dump, he was rearranging the stuff, so it would lie flat when you get more in there. And as soon as I let go, I remember that. And I looked out the window just in time to see him get smashed. He got up and he was okay. But how do you feel when you are solely responsible for somebody you love and respect suffering or loss? Raise your hand if you've ever been responsible for the death of 85 of the priests of God because you were hungry, because you were thirsty, because you were in rags, because you were unarmed, because you were desperate. You went for help to a priest who knew who you were, who respected your righteousness, and who would lose his life with 84 others because of you. That's when David writes Psalm 52. So turn back now to the 52nd Psalm. And when you get there, make sure you just write 1 Samuel 22. 1 Samuel 22. So you know forever when you read it now the circumstances that brought about these words in 52. Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? The loving kindness of God endures all day long. Your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor, O worker of deceit. You love evil more than good, falsehood more than speaking what is right. You love all words that devour, O deceitful tongue. But God will break you down forever. He will snatch you up and tear you away from your tent and uproot you from the land of the living. And the righteous will see and fear and will laugh at him. Behold, the man who would not make God his refuge, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and was strong in his evil desire. But as for me, I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the loving kindness of God forever and ever. I will give you thanks forever because you have done it. And I will wait on your name, for it is good in the presence of your godly ones. That's Psalm 52. Now, brethren, Psalm 52 is like 63. It's like a lot of psalms that David writes, where he says that despite all that I'm going through, I will praise and I will love my God. But as I read the psalm, and I think as you read the psalm too, don't the last couple of verses reveal, even in David, brethren, reveal to us a sense of how hard this is for him, that he's kind of working at giving God this praise? To me, it reads like he's in a place of terrible temptation. He's really being tried. Read those words again. He says in 8, as for me, I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. Brethren, he was anything but that. He was anything but that in his physical circumstances. And I think he's laying claim to it. He does like you and I do. This is what I choose to think of myself as. It's not what I really am, but it's what I choose to believe myself to be. Now, he really is that. He's being cared for by God. Then he says, I trust in the loving kindness of God forever and ever. Right? And that's what they call self-talk, I think, you know, in those motivational speakers' lingo. To where you're programming yourself. I will not fall prey to this temptation. I will not. I trust, despite all of this, I trust in the loving kindness of God forever and ever. If 85 priests die, I will trust in the loving kindness of my God. I will give you thanks forever because you have done it. Now, I think what that means is you are worthy of thanks. And I will wait on your name, for it is good in the presence of your godly ones. Brethren, whenever you're tempted, and we all are, to just want to despair and give up, my health is just never going to get better, and maybe it won't. Financially, I'm a ruin, and I don't know what I'm going to do about it. It never get any better, and maybe it won't. When Satan starts that endless whispering in your ear, see what serving God has done for you. See what God cares, you know, for you. See, it just doesn't pay. Brother, know that it does. Know that you haven't been anywhere near the circumstances of David, son of Jesse, Bethlehemite. Know that when he steeled himself to serve his God, that he did it in a crucible of suffering, the likes of which you and I can't ever know. And know that he was right. He was absolutely right. Nothing in this life can compare with the loving kindness of a merciful God who gave his own Son in our place to save us from what is far worse than the problems of this world, from sin that separates us from our God. The next time you're suffering, find Psalm 63, find 56 and 57 from last week, same time frame, and then 63 and 52. And surely God will be as merciful and as uplifting, as encouraging for you as he was for David, as David writes of it in these Psalms. If we can help you, though, David sought help, and if we can be of help, let it be known. Come speak with me if you have prayer requests, if you have questions of a biblical nature, if you're looking for some sort of help with a problem you're dealing with, if you're ready to become a Christian and join with us in the service of our King this morning. If we can help you in any way, come speak with me, please, as we stand and sing.